Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavirayam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu, Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Verse 198.
Atma katma ityukte, Atma katma ityukte, Yajna valkyo vibodhayan, Yajna valkyo vibodhayan, Vijnana mayam arabhya, Vijnana mayam arabhya, Asangantam paryasheshayat. Asangantam paryasheshayat. Atma katamaha iti ukte yagnyavalkyaha vibodhayam vijnanamayam arabhya asangam tam paryasheshayat. If you remember last week, the question was, who is actually the bhokta? Who is the enjoyer? Is the enjoyer just the kutasta atma, just pure satchitananda, the kutasta, which is like an anvil, which, like in the meditation, goes through, is a totally asanga? It can't be the kutasta, because the kutasta atma, the changeless atma, is that. It's not subject to any type of vikara, no type of modification, so it can't be that. Then the question is, well, then maybe it's the chitabhasa is the bhokta. The chitabhasa is what the ahankara identifies in the mind as the conscious being. Like if I can say, I am sad, for instance. The ahankara is identifying with the consciousness that is reflected in the vritti, right? But the consciousness that is reflected and identified in the vritti changes according to the vritti. Say if you have a vritti, thought modification, where you say, I am sad, then the next vritti is, say, you're happy. The sadness has gone away, now you're happy. Now the consciousness is identified with that state of mind in that particular vritti. And so the chitabhasa itself is subject to vikara, is subject to modification, because the thought is subject to modification. And the ahankara, the I notion, the ego, identifies with that thought. It identifies the consciousness with the thought. We say reflected consciousness. We say the reflected consciousness as though changes because the mind, which it's identified with, is changing. Except, say, if you say, I am sad, the consciousness is identified with the sadness. If you, then you say, I am agitated, the consciousness is identified with the sadness. And so that's the chitabhasa. It goes on taking the form, from the standpoint of the mind, from the standpoint of ignorance, ajnanam, it goes on taking on the qualities of whatever the mind is. And the mind, the buddhi, of course, is a vikari. A vikari means it itself has modifications. It is subject to modifications. So then, Vidyaranya says, you know, it can't just be the chitabhasa. Because there's no such thing as a chitabhasa, a reflection of consciousness, quotes, without consciousness. Right? If the consciousness, if the kutasta is the stable consciousness, the real consciousness is not there, there can't be a reflection of consciousness. So there is no chitabhasa by itself. For the chitabhasa, the reflection of consciousness, to be a knower, that's not possible. So then you're left with, okay, it can't be the kutasta, the stable, changeless atma. Can't be the reflection of consciousness, so therefore it has to be a combination of the two. Because that's all you've got left, basically. So, in the verse before this one, he says that in the world, in this verse 197, which is where we left off, he says, therefore in the world, the bhokta, the enjoyer, is said to be ubhaya atmaka, has for its nature, ubhaya, both of them. It's a combination of the chitabhasa and the kutasta. This is what makes the bhokta, the enjoyer. But he says, tadrik atmanam arabhya. In the beginning, initially we accept such an atma that is a combination of the chidabhasa and the atma and the kutasta. Initially, we all accept this because as a samsari, as a mumukshu, as a student, this is what you come with. You come with this, what we call anyonya adhyasa, this mutual superimposition where you take yourself actually to be the thought and the thought is you. So you come with this reality of I am the enjoyer. That's the reality that you come with. But upon analysis, he says, but in the end, he goes, wow, he actually says it, but in the end, the only thing that's left standing is the kutasta. That you, in fact, your being is not, in fact, the chidabhasa. You are not the reflection of consciousness. You are not something that you're objectifying. You're not something that comes and goes. And that's not a possibility, even. Just because of ajnana and because of ignorance, we take this kind of a mutual superimposition to be the reality, but in fact, it's an impossibility for you to be something that you're looking at, or for you to be a reflection. Say if you think of the sun reflecting, you know, in the water buckets, there's a reflection. There can be no reflection without the sun, nor could you ever be a reflection. So it's not possible. So yourself isn't going to be something that comes and goes, something that you're objectifying, something that you identify with as yourself. If it's an object that comes and goes, the only possible way that you can identify with that is through ajnana, through ignorance, through a lack of viveka, through a lack of discrimination. And the Upanishad, in fact, the pramana, this whole teaching methodology, its whole sole purpose is to solve this problem. Because we come into this life, beginning this lives, with a natural born ajnana, a natural born ignorance. It's not like you previously had knowledge. And you just forgot. You know, because from the standpoint of the upadhi, from the body, mind, sense organs, from this conditioning, what we call the conditioning adjunct, upadhi means, what we mean by upadhi, that is where I can make the mistake of the I, that is where the I can be identified with. That's the upadhi. I can say, I am the body. Even though the body is an object of my awareness, you know, it's something that changes and I'm aware, I illumine the change. Even in spite of all of that, I can still make this mistake and say, I am the body. That makes this body an upadhi because it's capable of the mistake. Right? It's capable of making that mistake. And so it can become a conditioning adjunct. That's how we translate upadhi. The mind, I can say, I am my thoughts, I am my feelings, I am happy, I am sad. Right? I am dull, I am agitated. Whatever the condition of the mind, I am that. I am a seer, I am a knower, I am a thinker. That means that the mind can take on the I can take myself to be that. There's an upadhi. I am a seer, I am a hearer, I am a taster, I am a toucher. Sense organs. They become upadhis because of that identification. So what allows for that identification is absolutely natural condition of the upadhi itself. The mind, by its very nature, has never not reflected or enjoyed consciousness. Never. And so why would the mind not think, I am the conscious being? And when in the history of beginningless lifetimes did the mind not reflect consciousness? Did the sense organs not reflect consciousness? Did the body not enjoy consciousness? And so, why would it not take itself to be that? Because whenever it is there, consciousness is there. It's just that when the Vedanta comes along and points out certain logical impossibilities to you about the oneness of that relationship, the mind becomes startled. It's a start, right? Because you recognize the absolute impossibility of the asanga atma, the kutasta atma, your being that is present to all of this changing phenomena, having an identity with, having a oneness with all of these experiences that actually leave. So it's a non-starter. It's a non-possibility. Right? And so as the Vedanta unfolds, as the Upanishad unfolds, you're left more and more and more. What is happening, all of these things that are subject to dismissal, subject to the mithya, to being something that is dependent on me for its being, but which itself comes and goes, all of those things are dismissed from your being as being intrinsic to your being. And so in the end, as the teaching methodology unfolds, because there, he's talking here about the Shruti. Shruti means the Upanishad, right? The whole teaching methodology. From what the, as when the Shruti finishes with its teaching, the Chirabhasa and this Ubhaya, the being both, all of this is dismissed, and what is left standing, what is left remaining, is only yourself, which is the Kutastha. Okay, so that's exactly what he said in 179. Now he brings in an example of Yajnavalkya teaching. Yajnavalkya is teaching to Janaka in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And here's what he said. Janaka comes to Yajnavalkya, who's the sage, and he says, Atma Ketamaha. Oh, which is the Atma? Yajnavalkya had already been talking about the different, you know, parts of the Upadi, and he was talking about the Vijnanamaya, the different koshas. He's talking about the Vijnanamaya kosha, the buddhi, separating the Atma from the buddhi. But then, of course, there's the manas, and there's the body, and there's the sense organs, and all of these different parts that make up the jiva. Right, you've got the physical body, you've got the mind, you've got the vital force, you've got the intellect, you have the sense organs, you have the ahankar, all of these different parts. So Janaka asks, Ketamaha Atma, which one of all these things that make up me is the Atma? Right? Because here I am with all of these upadis. What exactly, of all of them, Ketamaha, of all of them, what exactly is the Atma? So when asked this, so he says, Upte, Iti, when this is asked by Janaka, Atma Katama Iti Ute, then Yajnavalkya Vibodhyam, teaching him now. Now Janaka has, the king has asked him to teach. And now Yajnavalkya begins teaching him. Okay? Teaching him. What does he do? Vijnanamayam Arabhya. In his teaching, he starts with the Vijnanamayam. Means the buddhi, the intellect. So beginning with the Vijnanamaya, the intellect, he starts there. He could say, you are the Vijnanamaya is the Atma. Now, beginning there, right, because the buddhi, the intellect, enjoys consciousness. Right? The mind is not away from consciousness. Right? The mind is not away from existence. I mean, the self totally fills the mind. You could never say that the buddhi, the one that allows you to say, I am the knower, my intellect, is not a conscious being. That would not be true. The intellect is a conscious being. It totally enjoys consciousness. It totally enjoys me. That's why I can say, I am the intellect. I am my mind. Or another way we'd say, I am my mind. It's a definitive statement on the part of the mind. I am my mind. I am my thoughts. Why would it say that if you, in fact, are not the mind and the thoughts? Of course you are. But then the thing is, are the mind and the thoughts you? You are them. That's true. Because they have no distance. They are not distant from you in any way. Just like the pot, the clay can say, I am the pot. Definitely. I am the pot. Right? Because it is the pot. And in fact, without the clay, there is no pot. There's nothing there but me, the clay. That is the truth. But the pot can't say, I am the clay. In the sense, in this sense, that my being, my potness, the clay depends on my potness for its being. The clay, the pot depends totally upon the clay for its being, but the clay doesn't depend at all on the pot for its being. That is the satyam mithya, you know? And that's the reality that we have to differentiate in terms of our experience here. What is the satyam? What is the truth? What is the mityam? What is it in my experience at this moment where I can say, yes, all of this is my experience, this conscious being, just in reference to my intellect, to my mind. I can say, you know, I am the very self. I am the very truth of the mind. I am the clay of the pot. I am the truth. I am the conscious being which the mind enjoys totally. But which is not dependent on the mind for its being. Satyam mitya, that's what makes the mind mitya. How do I recognize this in my innermost, in my experience? Innermost experience means this is my experience. I recognize so simple, this is not rocket science. It's absolute, it's too simple, in fact. Swamiji's laughed about that it's too simple. The mind has to unwind and unwind and unwind and unwind to grasp something that is this basic and this obvious. What is basic and obvious is that I am present, the very self, the I, the conscious being, which is the self of the mind. But I am not dependent on the mind. The mind is dependent on me, because try to take consciousness away from the mind. The thought is dependent on me. If I take consciousness, if I take myself away from the mind, then from the thought, then who cares about it? It's nothing. It's not even there. But the thought can never touch me. It touch me in any way. I am the very self of the thought. But the thought never touches me. That's the asanga. And you have to see, is that true? You have to look and see. You have to see what the inner landscape is. The interior. What my interior is. What my inner landscape is. And what you find is Vijnanamaya Kosha, which is the buddhi, the intellect, enjoys me, the conscious being, but it itself is coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, thought after thought after thought after thought, intellection after intellection. And even the ahankar, I am doing this, I am thinking this, I am involved, that's all part of the Vijnanamaya Kosha, that very ahankar, definitive thinking. You know, I am doing this, I am doing this, I am thinking this, I am thinking this, I am thinking this. But all of this activity is taking place in the satyam, in the stability, in the asangaha, in the changelessness of my own presence. That's where the viveka is necessary. That's what I need to discriminate, is that fact. And so it's a question of recognizing the Shruti now, or Yajnavalkya, is pointing this out to Janaka. Please see. You know, it's not an intellectual type of a lecture, you know, as like a catechism. The self is satyam, right? The self is satyam, and the mind is mitya. The self, the self is changeless, and the mind depends for its being on the self. So take that down. That's not the Upanishad. The Upanishad is a pramana. Pramana means it's a means of knowledge. It's pointing to something that is yourself for you to recognize. It's pointing to your inner experience. What is the relationship of your being to all of the changing thoughts that are coming and going? So, in the teaching methodology, Yajnavalkya is talking in the Spruhadrandika. He's starting with the Vijnanamaya Kosha. So, Vijnanamayam Arabhya. Having begun there, Paradisheshyat, he takes it to what he's left with, Parishesha, totally, they're going all around, what is left remaining after he finishes with his teaching, is Tam Asangam, that Atma, that self, which is Asanga, which is completely free, which is completely unattached. The Asanga is that which, the Asanga Atma, is the one who remains as a constant amidst all of the changing vrittis. That Asanga Atma is the Kutastha, and that is what is left standing after the teaching is complete. So let's go to the next verse. He gives another example. Koyam atma ched yevam adau. Koyam atme chevam adau. Sarvatratma vicharataha. Sarvatratma vicharataha. Ubayatmakamarabhya. Ubayatmakamarabhya. Kutastakshetashritau. Kaha ayam atma iti evam adau sarvatra atma vicharataha. Atma vicharataha. Ubhaya atma atmakam arabhya kutastaha sheshate shritau. Now, after that particular example using the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, he makes a general statement. He says, wherever sarvatra atma vicharataha, wherever in the Shruti, this atma vichara, this analysis of the atma vichara is being done. In what form? How is the atma vichara being done? Kaha ayam. He says, kaha ayam atma evam adel. In such statements as, who is this atma? Kaha ayam atma. Who is the atma? Who is this atma? So every sarvatra means everywhere where this atma vichara, this analysis of the atma is being done for the disciple, the student, the sishya will come and ask the guru, ask the teacher, what is the atma? Who is the atma? Then that now, once this question comes, we need vichara. Vichara means analysis. Vichara, the word we tend to use with vichara just means the analysis of the nature of the atma. It's vichara, atma vichara. That vichara requires viveka, viveka jnanam, knowledge which requires discrimination. Viveka means discriminating between two things that are in the same place. An example for, two common examples for viveka. Red hot iron ball. If I have iron ball, which is round and heavy, iron, and I've heated it to make it red hot, I now have a red hot iron ball. It requires viveka now. Somebody sees a red hot iron ball. You don't know, unless you know, you don't know, that the redness and the hotness belongs to the fire. And the roundness and the weight belong to the iron. I need to discriminate. I need viveka to differentiate the one from the other. And then if I see them together, fine. I'm fine. I know fire is fire and iron is iron. I know what they are. I know that the weight is the iron, the roundness is the iron, the redness and the hotness is the fire. But since the two are appearing as one, viveka is required. Right? So that's one common example that's used. Another is the Hamsa bird. The Hamsa bird that goes to, this is just a myth, where the Hamsa bird is considered to be the greatest viveki. Because it goes to a bird bath that is filled, the bird bath is filled with half water and half milk. Right? And the Hamsa bird is able to suck out all of the milk, leaving the water behind. Viveka. Because the, and it takes very subtle, right, very subtle to be able to pull the milk out of the water. Yeah, because the two are really totally mixed in there together. In this situation, in our situation, the conscious being, the me, and the upadhi is totally, totally mixed. Right? It's not like the mind is over here and consciousness is over here. The body is over here and consciousness is over here. There is no gap. There is no distance or separation between the satyam and the mithya. Think of a clay pot. Viveka is necessary. You cannot separate the pot from the clay. You can separate the clay from the pot. All I have to do is just squash it. Pot's gone. But try to separate the satyam from the mithya. No, it's not possible. Now here, just looking at the upadhi itself, the body, mind, sense organs, how can you separate yourself, right, from the experience, because there is no distance between the self and the changing experiences that make up the creation. No distance at all. Just like clay pot, no distance. And so, however, there is a way, there is a something to distinguish between this mutual superimposition, and that is the satyam never changes. The existence, the being, never alters. Consciousness never alters. The meanness never alters, in spite of the changing names and forms, namarupas, changing names and forms, you know, continually altering. So that's what gives it away, you know. In the satyam mitya, there's something which is steady and changeless, and something which comes and goes. Now, in that real, that is the reality of our experience. So this viveka is there is something to do this viveka upon. And what we do this viveka, this atma vichara, this analysis of the self, what do we do this analysis upon? We do it upon our experience. I am here. Here I am, the conscious being. We're not talking about another conscious being. We're not talking about some subtle Brahman somewhere else. We're saying that this is Brahman. This is the Atma. Not some subtle Atma that we have to shut down all of our experience for in order to then have some sort of exalted, subtle experience that we travel into the subtle realms of something or other in order to have some awakening of an Atma, or which is Brahman, which is in the deep recesses of somebody else's place and whatever it is. That's not the vision at all. What we're talking about is this. This is the clay, this is the pot. This is the universe, this is Brahman. This is the universe, this is Atma. The Atma which is Brahman. This body, mind, sense organs is the Atma. There's not an Atma somewhere else. This is the clay of the pot. There's nowhere to go. It's simply a recognition at this moment of reality, this moment of my experience. There is satyam, there is mitya. The satyam is me, the very self that I, as an ajnani, not knowing anything, take myself to be. The very one that I take myself to be, that I say, I am the conscious being. That very self, right, is Brahman. And this self needs to be differentiated from all of the comings and goings of this manifest creation. Just viewed just as infinite manifest knowledge. It's not at anywhere, in any way away from me, but nothing about it. Nothing about this experience of infinite manifest knowledge that make up this creation has any type of substance. That's why it's continually changing. It's continually coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. You can't find it, in fact. When you go to, what I mean by that, when you go to analyze this creation that was that is really only the Atma, that is really only you, your being, you try to find something here other than just pure being existence. You analyze this creation. You can't find it in anything. Everything is infinitely divisible. Everything comes into being, goes out of being. And you know what? There are no exceptions. No exceptions. And so because of that, that's all, that the reality of that is the Achilles heel, you know, of ajnanam, of ignorance. You know? Because that's not true about yourself. You can't divide yourself, the Atma. You can't make it come and go. You can't modify it. You can't change it. You can't turn your back on it. You can't get away from it. You know, everything in the creation within time and space, you can turn your back on. You can get away from it. You can crush it. You can get rid of it. You can kill it. You can run away from it. You can do all kinds of things to get away from it. But the reality, the Atma, which is its very being, no matter where you go in terms of samsara, in terms of the creation, in terms of this manifest knowledge, wherever you go, it is there. Right? The Atma doesn't come and go. It's not subject to modification. You know? It's like if it's not a the space example is not the best example, but it does have some strengths. But just imagine, say, if I have a pot, and the pot is trying to run away from the space. Wherever it goes, you know? Wherever it goes, the space is already there. There's no place in this creation. That's why space is actually one drishtanta, one illustration that we use. You know, because space is from its own standpoint non-dual. It doesn't have any parts. There's only one space. It's all pervasive to the whole creation. And so therefore it's useful as an illustration. The difference is between Brahman, the Atma, and space is that space is not fire, is not water, is not earth. And so space is limited in that way. Whereas if we're talking about the reality of this creation, the satyam of this creation, it is the Atma, is the self of the fire, it is the self of the water, it is the self of the space, it is the very being of all that is. Right? And so that's why space has, and as any illustration, it has its limitations because it isn't the thing that we're really talking about. Right? So it's limited. If it were the same, then that would be fine. It's not the same. But we can still use it. And so when I say, like in the Upanishad says, you know, if I send my mind to the moon and back, the self is already there. See, if I get in a race with the self, who's going to get there first to the moon? If I send my mind to the moon, that's a long way to send the mind, but you can go there just like that. But when it's there, when it gets there, the self is already there. Right? You have the pot running around through space trying to get rid of the space. It can't. So like that, as an illustration, there is nowhere your mind can go that the self is not, because the self is the satyam, it's the very being, it's the very changeless truth of the mind. And so that changeless being that you cannot escape, you cannot get rid of, you cannot turn your back on, if you turn your back on, the self is illumining that. There's nowhere to hide, nowhere to go. But because of that, you can, the viveka, you can differentiate it from the mitya. The mitya is not that at all. The mitya is coming and going, changing all the time. Coming into being, going out of being. But the satyam is not, and you are the satyam. And so here, he's highlighting that. He says, everywhere in the Shruti, right, wherever this Atma Vichara is taking place, Sarvatra means everywhere. And how is it taking place? For instance, when I say something like, in the Shruti it says, who is the Atma? There's always going to be some sort of a question that initiates this Vichara. So everywhere where this Vichara is done, he says, it starts out, Ubayatmakam Arabhya. The Shruti will begin with the Atma being both the Chirabhasa Ubhaya and the Kutastha. We always start there because that's your experience. Mm-hmm. Remember, who's asking the question? Brahman is not asking the question. The one who's asking the question is the Ajnani, the person who wants to know, who am I? That's the mitya, body, mind, sense, organs, upadhi, is saying, who am I? You know, it's like the pot saying, please tell me, who am I? The body, mind, sense, organs, the upadhi says, who am I? Right? That's the Chidabhasa speaking, you know. But that Chidabhasa, who's asking the question, is not away from the one it needs to know. At the Chidabhasa, that reflected consciousness, the mind, body, sense, organs, asks, who am I? But the self that it wants to know is itself. So the Kutastha and the Chirabhasa are there. The Satyam and Nitya are there. That's where we start. So beginning with being two, the Kutastha Sheshate is the one left standing. Beginning with being the two, it's the Kutastha that's left standing. Because you're not in the end going to say, you're the reflection that you're looking at that comes and goes. Right? So what happens is, the Ahankara, the I, ego, which belongs to the Chidabhasa, belongs to the mind, instead of saying, I am, the mind recognizes, has recognized, the mind itself has recognized its own mityatva. The mind itself recognizes its own mityatva, its own dependence on me, the changeless self. Now the thing is, because your self is consciousness, it's self-evident. It's because you are consciousness that all of these things are illumined. You don't need to come and illumine. You know, the teaching doesn't have to come and illumine you. You, in fact, are illumining the teaching. You're the conscious being because of whom this teaching is even being heard, is even recognized. But this conscious being that I am, this me that I am, is not doing anything. It is innocent. I'm very simple. The conscious being that you are is pure. You're absolutely simple, but absolutely strong. It's the strength of simplicity. You are the self, which is the being of this universe. You couldn't be more strong. You can't be budged, right? And that's your, in fact, as you recognize yourself, you realize the tremendous strength, the tremendous, that's why they say kutasta, like an anvil. Your being is immovable, you know, and it is strong, it is pure, it is whole. And you are always there as the very anvil, the very one that pervades all experience, and nobody can do anything about it. You can't do anything. Your mind can't do anything, your body can't do anything, sense organs can't do anything, and nobody else can do anything, the universe can't do anything. And that's a tremendous relief for the mind, especially when you realize, oh, I can't hurt myself. I can't blow it. You know, I might do all kinds of stupid things, make all kinds of mistakes on my path to trying to become a better person. All kinds of stuff. But my Atma remains Asanga. My self remains Asanga. There's nothing that can be done. No way to hurt it. And so always my mind has that absolute safety. It's not the mitya safety. It's the absolute safety of the reality of my being. And that's where my mind hangs out. That's where my mind rests. You know, that's the moksha. The moksha is in the recognition that my being is liberated. The mind's recognition that I am liberated. Not that it is liberated, it's mitya. Its truth is liberated. Its self is liberated. I am liberated. The mind is something which is part of the manifest creation. You know? And its truth, it's like the clay, it's like the pot saying, I am liberated. But what does it mean? It means I am clay. That's why I'm liberated, not because I'm the pot. I'm liberated because I am clay. It recognizes I am clay, that's the reality. So the jnani, the one who has knowledge, recognizes I, this me, am free. I am a sangha. I am whole and complete, and nothing can change that. It's not something that needs, I don't need to maintain my wholeness or my completeness. I don't need to worry about it. I don't need to protect it. I don't need to do this and do that and do this and do that so that it won't be taken away from me or I won't destroy it, you know, on this hierarchical ladder toward perfection. You know, I might, you know, fall off the ladder. You know, if I fall off the ladder, you know, then I might hurt myself and have to try to, you know, scrounge my way all the way back. But once you know yourself is there at the bottom of the ladder and it's there at the top of the ladder, you know. It's there when the mind is happy, it's there when the mind is sad, it's there when the mind is struggling, it's there when the mind is shanti. The Atma is there as the very asanga self of the mind. The mind recognizes that. That is the strength of the mind, because that frees the mind of its having to be perfect. The mind has to be perfect so that I can be the Atma. No. You are the Atma, whether the mind is perfect or not. And that Atma is as much there present in exactly the same way as it is in the imperfect mind, as it is in the so-called perfect mind. Of course, there is no perfect mind, because the mind by its nature is always changing. You know, and so if there's a moment of perfection, what's the next moment? What's going to happen? The Atma is the one that's perfect in its changelessness, in its abiding, in its ananda. But that's what needs to be recognized. So, let's do this next verse. Kutastha satyatam swasmin adyasya atma vivekataha tatvikim bhoktratam natva nakadachit jahasati. This is a really nice little verse. He says, kutastha satyatam swasmin adyasya atma avivekataha tatvikim bhoktratam matva na kadachit jihasati. He says the atma, and here the atma is just the jiva, the person. The person, the atma, having adyasya, having superimposed on itself the kutastha, which is satya, the truth of the kutastha. So here the jiva, the mind, we call the atma because I, as a jnani, I take myself to be this. So I, it's just a way of saying, having superimposed on myself the kutastha, the atma, which is the truth, kutastha satyatam. So having superimposed on myself the atma, how, why? Avivekataha, because of lack of discrimination. So here I am, the upadi, the jiva. Now I have superimposed on my body, mind, sense organs, this person here. I have superimposed my being, the kutastha atma, which is the reality. Why have I done that? It's not that I had any other, there was no prior condition. It's because of aviveka. It's because of lack of discrimination. Because that's just how I take, define my experience. But having done that, then, tatvikim bhoktratam matva, then, that being the case, having done the superposition, then matva, now, having known, therefore, that this bhokta, this enjoyer, is the reality, tatvikim. I, the bhokta, the enjoyer, I am tatvikim. I am the reality. I am the real person here. Why? Because I've superimposed the atma on the enjoyer, and therefore the enjoyer becomes the real person, right? So what every samsari feels, everybody feels that, here I am the person, this is me, right? So because of the avivekha. Now, once that's happened, then what? Then nikadachit jahasati. Then that person never wants to give it up. Because it's me. As long, if I take the enjoyer, this body, mind, sense organs, me, to be me, because of avivekha, because of this red-hot iron ball superimposition, then that's this is me, this is the reality, this is who I am. Then do I want to give that up? It's like committing suicide. How could I want to give it up? That's be wanting to give up me, and there is nothing more dear to me than myself. Right? So I will hang on to that for dear life. Now what's interesting is that when this knowledge takes place, the mumukshu, the student, comes to this knowledge, to the teacher, and this knowledge starts being unfolded, and the ahankar, the ego, that says, I am this, says, hey, wait a minute, you know, what about me? Are you saying that I'm not me? Are you saying that I'm not me? Or that I'm not real? Are you saying that I'm not real? You know, which is not what's being said at all. In fact, you are real. You are the satyam. You are the satyam. But the mind, the body, the sense organs are not, you are not dependent on their being. They are dependent on you. You're not dependent on them. You know, it's not that you, the enjoyer, are not that. You are that. But that you is free. of the mind, free of the enjoyer. But that requires a lot of teaching. Because a lot of seeing from a lot of different, by teaching I mean seeing it from a lot of different perspectives. Because the identity is so much. And the whole creation supports this identity. Like this body, mind, sense organs, person fits into the schema of the creation. Just like, you know, if you have a dream at night, the dream characters in the dream fit into the schema of the dream. They're there, part and parcel of the dream, to experience, to see, to hear, to touch, to walk, to have hand, to grasp. The whole upadhi is meant to participate in the dream story. And, you know, and like that, this whole upadhi is meant, designed to participate in this, in the story of this creation. It's part and parcel of it. It's not meant to recognize the Atma, which is the self, which is the very truth of the creation. That's just the reality. The body, mind, sense organs are like an instrument to experience the creation. But then this person who's who's like an instrument to experience the creation all of a sudden says, what's going on? Who am I? What is really the truth here? Is there anything about me that is real? Is there anything about me that survives all of the change of this creation? And then the Upanishad comes and teaches. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm. Yes, it's okay, don't worry. This is what's going on. But it doesn't come to teach the Rishi, the teaching, the Sampradaya, the teacher-student Sampradaya that's been going on from the beginning of time. Doesn't manifest itself for anyone who's not interested in it. Just like the rest of the creation, you know, like I use the example of if you want to buy a new car and you decide you want a Volvo, then when you're driving around, all you see are Volvos everywhere. Yeah? Right? But if you have no interest in cars, you're not going to buy a car, you have no care, you know. There may be hundreds, thousands of Volvos around, you don't even notice. Same here. You have a question now. That question from the standpoint of the Mumukshu, one who desires liberation, has this question. Before you were just a samsari in the creation, just doing what you're supposed to be doing. All of a sudden you want to know. You want to know what it is. And so then you attract that knowledge to you because the question is correct. You have the question. And so then the creation will give you the answer. It's not just true in terms of this. It's kind of how it is. You know? And then when this comes and there's this unfoldment takes place, honestly, it is the most obvious thing in the world. So that when Shankara wrote the Brahma Sutras, you know, which is an analysis of all of the Upanishads, everything that's said, and all of the different darshanas and everything, in his Adhyasa Bhasha, which is an introduction to the Brahma Sutras, he says, how is it possible that this isn't immediately recognized when it's so obvious? How can it be? Because when you're told and you see it, your mind just goes, it's kind of a no-brainer, so many of the things, you know. But why is it that it's not seen? Well, because of beginningless ignorance. Because actually, there's no reason for the mind is not required to see that unless it asks a question. And if you're so engaged in the creation, you know, fulfilling your needs in the creation, that question need not come up. Because yourself is always immediately accounted for, you know, by the creation. Like I can say, you know, I am teaching a Vedanta class right now. Okay? That takes care of the I, doesn't it? Right? For now, I'm totally taken care of. The I is defined, you know. And it's defined every moment in terms of all of your different relationships, what you're doing, where you're going, how you're feeling. It's I am feeling this, I am going there, I am doing that, I am of this such and such an age. It's I, always defined by the environment. So there's nothing that requires you to say, who am I? Because all that question is continually answered in your situation, by your relationships, So something in your mind has to go, no, who am I really? Who is the one that is playing all of these different roles? What is the truth of all of this? That's a different, it's like a meta level, it's a different level of a question that need not come. So they consider, and the Shruti will consider, when that question actually comes in a real way, you know, that's considered tremendous punya. Because tremendous punya, because the mind need not ask that question. What gives it the composure, or what would they say, like the shanti, the self-reflectiveness, or the space, the inner space, to even ask the question? You know, it's considered a very huge grace to even ask that question. And then once that question is asked, the universe is so designed, as the Vedanta will say, the universe is so designed that within that you become united with that teaching, so that you will, so that you can know. It's a very simple rule. And everybody has their story. You know? You had the question, and then and this is how it all worked out for you. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Just take a minute. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
When you say that the mind goes to the moon and it finds that the self is already there, what exactly do you mean by meaning?
That acts in the creation is large. The moon is a long distance away from this physical body, right? And so the idea is, if I send my mind to the moon, you know, how fast the mind can objectify the moon, just like that. So, but the self is faster.
In what respect?
Because the self is, the self is already there. In other words, there's nowhere where you can send the mind where the self isn't already there. Because the self is the very conscious being, which is the underpinning, the very self of where. So wherever the mind goes, the self is already there. That's the idea.
So actually, I never studied that example. I always think oddly. So it means sending the mind to the moon means just thinking of the moon.
Yeah, that's all.
Objectifying it.
Yeah,
okay,
but you see, like in the creation, okay, here, I'm sitting right here, and I'm saying, you know, it'll see out the window of the moon or something. The moon is way there.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm looking, like, at the stars in the creation, which is very far away, reference to the body.
Yeah.
But the mind can objectify, can as though, go to the moon, objectify it immediately. Yeah. But I am already there.
How is that? How is that the self already there?
Because the self, there's no place where the self is not. Okay. Consciousness is the very substratum of the whole creation.
Mm-hmm. In that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What did you say?
The context?
Well, the self, the Atma, is the very consciousness which, in fact, the whole creation is the self of the whole creation. Just like if I use the example of the dream. The dream comes from consciousness, as for an individual, the dream comes from consciousness, is sustained by consciousness, goes back into consciousness. So the consciousness is there as the very substrate reality of the dream. And so say the dream is there, and in the dream there's a dream character and there's a moon, you know. And dream characters, all dream characters enjoy the same consciousness. The dream world, universe, world enjoys the same consciousness. The dream moon enjoys the same consciousness. The intervening space enjoys the same consciousness. So the consciousness is the self of the whole creation. And you can say, this individual has a mind that then objectifies the moon, right? But just like moving a pot through space, right, the space is already there. Say the pot is trying to race space to its destination, you know? But wherever it goes, the space is still there, already there. So like that, in the whole creation, there's nothing here but consciousness. So no matter if you can go to the end of the creation, you know, the consciousness is still already there.
But sometimes it's confusing the use of the word consciousness, because a lot of times we equate consciousness with the mind, and we don't equate it with things that don't have minds.
That's right.
So
you could say the isness is already there, but you know what? When you're using an example like this, it's better if you've already made the identity between isness and consciousness.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's kind of a hard word.
Yeah.
But that's all a part of that picture then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Good.
Can you say more about when there's a question, the creation provides the answer?
I was just kind of talking what we say about the synchronicity or the oneness of the universe that we experience. So I wasn't trying to make a really hard and fast rule, but I think that, you know, like when you're searching, when you become interested in something, then the world opens up to you around that interest. Say you're interested in subject matter. You had no interest in it before, but now you're interested in it. Well, once you're interested in it, then all kinds of opportunities start opening up for you around that subject matter. You know? Or you want to buy something. You know? Then all of the things around that world, around that object, start opening up. So now, in terms of this knowledge, when you want to know yourself, when that becomes not a real desire, it's like if you want to know something, it has to be a real desire. Nothing opens up because there's nobody there to pursue. But when it's a real desire, then you'll find things, the universe starts opening up for you around that. Swamiji's talked about that before. It's also in the tradition, you know, that when you're ready for this knowledge, then the teacher will come to you. It says that. But I love that, and I believe that also, but I'm demystifying it a little bit, because in fact that's how the universe is. You know, once you are interested in something, and Swamiji talked about it recently in a more demystifying way, just as I'm talking about it now. When you are interested in something, you want to know something, and the question is correct. In other words, like say, for instance, what I mean by that, say, I want liberation. Okay? I want liberation, but what do I think, what do I see liberation as being? Astral traveling, you know? Or
wrong.
Or I say, I want liberation. How do I define it? I define it as having meditative experiences. Okay? That's what I'm seeking, because I think that's liberation. Now, that's still, from a Vedantic perspective, that's still samsara. It's like, I think liberation is becoming wealthy, because I'll be liberated from the bondages of poverty.
Or not having any thoughts.
Yeah.
Stopping your mind.
Yeah, or stopping my mind. That's liberation. But see, this is how I'm defining it, and then that is what I'm seeking, right? And then the universe opens up opportunities for me around this thing that I'm actually seeking. But now, what if what we say, what if the person is a mumukshu? They desire liberation, and meaning that's defined as this, that sadhana chatushtya, they're an adhikari. They're a qualified student, which means that the question The question is correct. They have, first of all, they have viveka. The person has viveka. What does that mean is that they've recognized that there is nothing in the creation that is nitya. Everything is anitya. Means everything is bound by time, subject to birth and death. That's viveka. There's nothing here in the creation that's stable. Therefore, I have vairagya. The viveka leads to vairagya. Vairagya means, if that's so, if everything in the creation is subject to birth and death, subject to change, there's zero possibility of me gaining anything stable here. Anything lasting, anything that I can relax into and count on, because it doesn't exist. That's a huge realization, because what that means is that then there's no possibility of me finding a resting place or any, you know, anything whole or complete here, because that's not the nature of the creation. It's not like I'm inadequate to find that. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the nature of the creation. It's not even that the creation is bad, good or bad. It's just this is how the creation is. And therefore, there is nothing, no liberation for me here in terms of freedom from change, freedom from birth, freedom from death, or gaining any type of lasting wholeness or fullness. If that lasting wholeness or fullness is dependent in any way on the creation, because there is nothing lasting in the creation. So this, the mind has had to have these recognitions. And then the thing is, the mumukshutvam will come. The desire for liberation. And it comes in this way. I have a desire for liberation because I can't solve this problem myself. You know, it's a desire for liberation which negates all of these topical solutions that I used to have. I will be full and complete if I get a new car, if I could just get a new home, if I could have more money in the bank, if I could have a stable partner, if my children were good to me, on and on and on and on. If all of these criteria, if all of these things, or my job, if I could get the promotion, if I could get a raise, well, on and on and on. Or if all of these people would respect me properly. There's all of these things, you know, that I think if I could just get all of the pieces of the puzzle correctly, then maybe I would be full and complete. At some point, the mumukshu is the one who realizes, no, that not even that will work. It won't work. Because there's nothing constant. You can't take a still shot, you know. And so then when your desire for liberation is real, there's no solution for you, and that's when the Upanishad becomes meaningful. You know, and they say that for a mumukshu, somebody has really realized the problem. The Upanishad, this teaching, is, they've used the example of a person whose hair is on fire, how they would head toward the lake. If somebody's hair is on fire and there's the lake, they're not just going to kind of saunter over. That's the example they use. That's the mumukshu. But what I'm saying is that when these realizations are there, you know, then the question becomes proper. The problem is understood. The question becomes proper. And then there is something in the universe to deal with this question. With this understanding of liberation, that there is something in the universe, the Upanishad, that deals exactly with that. You know? I'll say if that isn't the question. Say if that, you call it liberation, but if this is not the liberation you're talking about, then your mind will take you off toward that. And that will be there too. There are meditative experiences where you can have non-dual experiences. Of course, you come back from them. You know, but you can be taught how to have those type of experiences. You can learn how to astral travel. You know, there's so many things you can do. And they are what they are. It's not that they're good or bad. It's that when you think that they're going to liberate you, just like if you think wealth or this or that is going to liberate you, that's when it's a problem. The thing in itself is not a problem. It's only what, if you, you will end up very disappointed if you've misdefined that thing. You think it's going to give you something that it can't give you. Right.
Which is basically what we think about
everything. Everything. Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, the when you become a mumuksha, it's like having your hair on fire because all of a sudden you realize, oh my God. And they say, you know, you throw yourself, your hands up to the Lord and say, if you're there, now is the time. If you exist, now is the time.
It's kind of odd that the Upanishads, they're found in India, or like it's the only location, really.
Yeah, but you know what?
On the planet, you know?
But you have to think of it differently than that.
Okay.
When you go back in time, you know, because we're going back with the Upanishads, we're going back thousands and thousands of years, not even 2,000 years, we're going back in time. And as you go back in time, mm-hmm. all of these continents, you know, these civilizations disappear. You know, and you get just to as kind of a small little areas. So we're talking about, okay, the Upanishads, when we go way back in time, we found they originated in this area. We think, you know. But these areas, there was no United States that we know of, or Canada, you know, or Europe. This is all part of a migration.
Well, I wonder why it didn't walk around the world then, like everybody else.
Well, it's here.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you need a microscope to find it.
Not really, you know. I wouldn't look at it like that.
Okay, that's
the
right.
Different, there are different cultures, like there's the Hindu culture, and there's the Japanese, and cultures all over the, different cultures all over the world. But even in the Hindu culture, even though the Upanishads are there as part of the Vedas, they are as hidden, as much hidden to a samsari Hindu as they are to a samsari Westerner, because the question isn't there. You can say that the Indian, the Hindu has an advantage. They do have some advantages in a way, because they know at least that there is such a thing as the Upanishads. There is such a thing as moksha, as liberation. It does. They don't care about it, that's all, because they're not even moksha. But they do know that when I do care about that, it's there.
Yeah.
That's a great relief. You know, and also maybe a worldview that is more conducive to the shanti of an individual. Like, for instance, even an understanding of reincarnation or the transmigration of the soul, as opposed to there just being one shot. Here you are, there's no reason that you're here, there's nothing that you did before, this is just it. And you will die and try to squeeze everything into this one time. That's a highly pressure cooker. You know?
It's
a lot, isn't it? It's a lot of stress.
But you know, even though sometimes I feel stressed thinking about rebirth, you know, because like there's no guarantee. I mean, although I've heard Swamiji say, something like comparing it to being at a bus stand and the bus driver's going, motion, motion, motion. Once you've gotten on that bus, that's the only bus you ever get on afterwards, even if you're reborn.
Well, what they say in the, I see what you mean, like you're afraid, I better get this knowledge now.
Exactly. Yeah. In this birth, while I have, you know, this opportunity, because who knows what could be waiting.
Yeah, except say if you start understanding Ishvara as a whole. Interconnected, the whole creation is interconnected, right? Then you're in this lifetime, you're getting some knowledge, and so that knowledge, you'll have to see that through. You're already on that path of fructification, and that's exactly what, because Arjuna had the same problem to Krishna, because he said, you're teaching me all of this and it all is clear now, but by the time, you know, when I go out in the middle of the battlefield, I'm sure I'm going to lose it all. And I might get killed. What would happen to me? What would happen to me? Because now I know this, but I don't have nishta in it yet. And so Krishna said, you know, you'll either be born in the house of, right away in the house of the yogis, people already have knowledge, or you'll be born into a dharmic household and you'll pick it up later if there's certain things, karmas that you need to fulfill, but you won't lose that thread. You know? So you need shraddha in that.
See, Vidya has no problem.
Well, you know what's nice, though? You do need some shraddha in that, because it's a belief, right?
Yeah.
But it makes sense, and it's nice that at least it's been addressed. You're not the only one asking the question. But I'm talking really not for mumukshu so much as just a samsari that to have a world view that this is your only time here. There's no prior condition that brought you here. There's no justice in terms of why you would have this situation and another person would have that situation, another person that situation, because there's no prior condition for any of you. You'll live this life and then you'll go to heaven, hell, or purgatory. You know,
I think
so. But I think that is high pressure. You know, also not having the concept of moksha, not having punya, papa, dharma, all of these types of things are just not there. And I think that it's just a lot easier on your psyche. I find the Hindu understanding, because it's Vedic, the Hindu understanding is based in the Vedas, they're based in the Upanishads, and I just see it much easier on the soul, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be over romantic about this or anything, but it seems like if you're a mumukshu and you're a European, you know, that doesn't have any contact with India, or you're some indigenous person in South America, it seems like you're not going to run across the opponent. If you have this question of, well, what is really here? The answer won't come to you if you're in Brazil as an indigenous person, it seems to me. It's not, the knowledge is not available. Is that,
well, you got it.
Why I run over to India, you know?
But you did run over to India and you got it. And it's just a matter of shraddha, really, Edward. But like Swami, you have to think, like Swamiji, what he used to always kind of teach is, even if you're in Timbuktu, that was his big joke. Even if you're in Timbuktu,
yeah,
somehow you'll connect with this teaching if that question is there.
Really?
And if you see that the whole creation is Ishwara, it's not an inert creation.
Mm-hmm.
It's all interconnected, infinite knowledge, infinite order.
Mm-hmm.
And so your sankalpa, your pravritti, is, you know, your what you're moving toward, the impetus that pushes you towards something, and the resolve in your mind plays is part of that creation, you know. So you attract to you, you know, what you need. So.
Okay.
We also say that the teacher will come to you. The teacher is eagerly looking. Teacher is eagerly looking for the student, as the student is looking for the teacher. So.
Now I'm struck by the fact that when I was living in Mendocino County, Swamiji was living right up the road from me, and I used to see his picture on posters at the post office.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I used to kind of like, oh, that sounds different. You know, and when I was in Bali, one of his senior students, I used to go and hear his... I'm not sure his name, but he looked... And I would think, well, that's interesting. I like that. You know, it was only here that I really connected to that.
Yeah. Yeah, whenever. You know, it happens when that connection is made, when your mind's ready for that connection to be made. Otherwise, it can be just right there in front of you.
Yeah.
It happens so often, not just with Vedanta. I mean, you have
everything.
You have instances like that, you know.
But I do think it's, when you say, the scriptures also say it's punya. I mean, you know, your punya, your samskaras have to ripen, that punya has to... Because I was looking for a teacher for 11 years, and you were here, and my samskaras just didn't, you know, I didn't... That's what I think.
Yeah, it was only through the greatest, what looks like chance, that I even ever found this study. Certainly not from looking for it.
Yeah, I don't think it's chance.
It seems so unlikely that it
would. Yeah. Yeah. It's a night.
<Is that? laughs>